Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Lawdown. My name's Wanu Sander. I'm a senior associate at CM Murray, and I have today with me two of my amazing colleagues, Emma Bartlett, a partner at the firm, and Pooja Dasgupta, a senior associate. So today we've got three stories that we wanted to cover and discuss some of our views and insights on. The first is in relation to the four-day working week pilot. We're also going to discuss a call for action from Dina Asher-Smith in relation to the effect of periods on sports performance. And we are also going to discuss the RAF head of recruitment, who claimed that the recruitment policy breached discrimination legislation because they were required to meet steep diversity targets, which were unfavourable to white men. So to kick off, I'm going to start with the story about Dina Asher-Smith, the athlete who has recently called for more research into the effect of periods on performance after she was affected her period, causing her to pull up with a cramp during a 100 meter final in the Munich Championships during the summer. She phrased it as being girl stuff that had caused her to have a calf cramp. And identified that this has now become a huge topic for women in sports. And often it isn't something that's actually spoken about. There are quite a few, you know, women in sports who must obviously have the impact of their periods affecting their performance. And she identified that you do see people who have a dip in performance, and behind the scenes, perhaps what's going on is that they are struggling with effects of their periods. She's called for some research and more funding from a sports science perspective into how periods affect women in sports. So we thought we could discuss this more generally from a sports science perspective, but also in the workplace context and how employers might deal with employees who are off sick, maybe with period pain. Sometimes they might report it and sometimes might not. And what we could be doing to also raise more awareness and all this better in the workplace. So one of the first things I think we thought was important was that the fact that Asher-Smith was able to actually, you know, speak about this is the first step. It's being more openly discussed alongside things like the menopause, which has also had a lot of coverage. There'd been a lot of documentaries. I think there was one by someone might help me here. There was one on Channel 4.
Oh, yeah, sorry, the one with Davina McCall, was it?
With Davina McCall. And that was also an attempt to just get the subject out there and have people not consider it to be a taboo subject. Also, you know, raising awareness about the effect of periods on athletes should hopefully lead to people being more open about sharing when they have problems. And hopefully from a sports science perspective as well, looking into how they could be best supported during those times. I don't know, Emma, if you had any comments that you wanted to add, because I know you had some thoughts about this as well.
Thanks, Wanu. I think it's incredibly reflective of a modern environment where Dina Asher-Smith is able to firstly raise it. Obviously, she's top of her game, so she's feeling probably a little bit more confident in discussing these issues. But the up and coming women within sport will feel less able to do so. And quite rightly, this is something where athletes, it's all about the marginal gains, and sports psychology and sports science are always researching how to improve those marginal gains. So this is a really key area, and surprisingly to me that this hasn't been something which has been researched to the hilt already. But I just found it fantastic that it can raise awareness, firstly, that there are athletes that have periods and these can have a negative impact on their performance. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about it. It's no longer, hopefully, a taboo subject. And I hope that people don't feel uncomfortable just even saying the word period, rather than referring to these things as women's problems or women's issues. And that's hugely reflective of how the menopause discussion has developed in the last 12 months, to the point where it's now being discussed or has been discussed openly in Parliament. I mean, it's no longer a taboo subject if they're talking about it in Parliament. And you know, the proposal from the Women and Equalities Committee is that menopause should be a protected characteristic. It just shows how leaps and bounds women's problems should be something which cannot be derided. And so coming into the workplace, hopefully women or employees who suffer from periods, so not everybody identifies as a woman will have a period still, but where you have an employee who has a period, the employer will want to know what it is, and that's causing them to perhaps need a little bit of extra time or support, or you know, perhaps they'll need to do something to help them cope with the impact of not all periods are the same. They don't always have the same impact on somebody. Somebody may need to get up and walk around and get some exercise. They may need to take extra water on during the day. And it's things like that, that all the, you know, they're really minor adjustments that need to be made. But yeah, great that it's being discussed. And I'm sure this is the start of a discussion about it rather than the end of it.
I think it's also just to add to that, I think it's quite interesting to see what other countries, what their attitudes are towards, you know, how to approach, you know, period pains and the impact that it could potentially have on people in the workplace, in the work context. And I know that I think countries like Japan, for example, have a kind of legal concept of menstrual or period leave, but I don't necessarily whether the uptake of what the uptake is of that leave. And actually I've seen some argument that it can lead to, you know, people who do go through periods, etc., and those people feeling like they are treated differently in some way. And so I think there are obviously pros and cons of kind of highlighting that, you know, people that have periods might need certain accommodations and potentially reasonable adjustments in the kind of legal aspect of it. So I think it's more a kind of you need to consult and just speak to your staff and take a kind of human approach and see on an individual basis what that person might need, what difficulties they're facing as a result of the, you know, this, that, you know, going through the period, and, you know, what help they might need on a kind of case by case basis.
Yeah, I think that's right. You sort of mentioned Japan. I think South Korea is probably another country that's got this right to period leave, and the take up hasn't been huge. I think when it was introduced, there probably weren't also attendant rights in the workplace that supported people. And the attitudes of people more generally to, you know, people with periods taking time off work maybe two or three times in a month also can be quite negative. So employers do need to have a more holistic approach to the way that they deal with people taking sick leave for periods, because it could be in relation, you know, to things that Emma's mentioned that could help them stay in the workplace, or it could be introducing other flexibility, for example, if they're able to work from home on the days that they might be suffering particular pain. There are multiple ways that it could be dealt with. And I mean, the first avenue I would probably say is that, you know, the usual process of a sickness absence process would apply, and speaking to the person one-on-one to find out, as you say, Pooja, specifically what this, you know, the sickness is, and if there are any symptoms, what those are and how they might be able to be helped is step one, and being sensitive about that. So managers need to be trained on how to deal with that. If someone's coming back to work after having taken a few days off, hopefully not having a huge reaction going, well, why did you take a day off for a period? You know, that's probably not what you want to be doing. You do need to be sensitive. There are risks of discrimination, of course, sex discrimination, if employers don't deal with it appropriately. So that is a risk to bear in mind. But equally, you also just want to be supporting the well-being of your staff more generally. So that's just not the way to deal with it.
There might be, sorry, just the last point on that, there might also be an underlying medical condition that you might need to explore with that individual, because I know that my understanding is that people that suffer from endometriosis have kind of similar symptoms to, you know, what you might ordinarily think as period pains, but actually it might not have been diagnosed yet. So there could be something underlying that you won't find out unless you actually just speak to that person and potentially refer to OH if it is really impacting that person's ability to do their work.
Yeah. Oh, and sorry, just before we do move on to the next thing, the other thing I thought I wanted to mention is that in some work, it says you might also just need to reconsider the facilities that you have available. If there aren't toilets on the relevant floor and someone has to run up to the top floor, for example, you could see a reason why they don't want to be doing that. They're suffering from heavy or painful periods. So these are things that I think employers could be, you know, considering to support their employees who have periods, as well as being open, as we've discussed, and trying to be more normalize the discussion so nobody's scared to say period.
That's very well put, Wanu, and actually that was one of the adjustments that is recommended in one of the menopause cases before the employment tribunal, was looking at where one of the workers who had some very serious adverse impacts from her menopause, she was relocated within the building so that she had quick access to facilities as well. That's a really good point.
I think that's the end of our discussion of that point. And we're going to move on to the next story, which is the RAF head of recruitment who claimed unfavourable treatment to white men.
Yeah, thank you. This is something which has been running for about a week, where the RAF head of recruitment refused to follow an order to prioritise women and ethnic minority candidates over white men, because she believed that the order was unlawful. And defence sources have said that they had been course loading. So the RAF has a system where it's a first past the post in the recruitment process. So, and at the same time, they have set some very ambitious diversity targets to improve the makeup of their RAF candidates, and the current workforce is predominantly white male. So obviously some ambitious targets to increase the proportion of women and ethnic minorities within that group. But the recruitment process, if it's first past the post and you've already got this cohort of white male, and whilst all of their recruitment adverts, you would have seen them on the TV, fantastic, where they've got role models of women and ethnic minorities advertising how brilliant the role is, that has increased the number of candidates, but they're still stuck in this recruitment pipeline. So my understanding is that the direction was to prioritize the women and ethnic minority candidates over white men, and one of the allegations, I believe, is that there is actually a halt on the recruitment of white men to allow the recruitment prioritisation of women and ethnic minority candidates to hit these diversity targets. So it's quite explosive, it's quite controversial, and it brings about, from an employment context, a really good discussion on what is positive action, which is something which is permitted under the Equality Act, which it's not mandatory, but it's a voluntary measure that employers can take if they recognise that if they want to overcome a disadvantage or meet specific needs or combat underrepresentation of people with protected characteristics. So where they recognise, as the RAF did, that their workforce didn't reflect the makeup of society, so the candidate pool from which they were drawing from wasn't representative, there are a range of measures which they can take, which are permitted under the Equality Act, which allow them to target their recruitment towards the underrepresented groups. And there's some really fantastic examples of what this is. And I've just referred to the advertising campaign, which introducing role models where women and ethnic minority candidates can say, well, look, there I am, that's me doing an engineering job within the RAF. And they understand that they do. There is a career in there for anybody who's not a white man, but the positive action measures can only be applied in certain circumstances, and there are some quite stringent conditions set out in the Equality Act, and they are, there's three of them, and it says firstly the positive action measure can be applied in recruitment and also promotion, but in recruitment to select someone with a protected characteristic over somebody who doesn't have that protected characteristic for the job. So this is more than just targeting your recruitment. This is at the point where you're going to offer employment or a contract to somebody. If you want to lift up the person with a protected characteristic over the person who doesn't, they firstly have to be as equally qualified as each other. And so you have to be satisfied that that's the case. Secondly, the employer has to ensure that they don't have a policy of treating that group more favourably in connection with the recruitment than persons who do not share that protected characteristic. And then thirdly, the employer has to be satisfied that taking that measure is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim, i.e. the legitimate aim being getting better diversity within the workforce. And it's proportionate to do so, taking into account the extremity of the need or underrepresentation. So I guess the accusation here is that if you have a policy which says halt the white male recruitment and lift the people sharing these protected characteristics into the workforce, that's going to potentially breach the second condition there, if there is a policy. And obviously I have to stress that the RAF denied that there is a policy amounting to unlawful positive discrimination, but equally there's a question as to whether if you're just going to give priority to people with protected characteristics in the candidate pool, have you satisfied yourself that they are as equally qualified as the ones who are being disadvantaged in this process? So, Pooja, I know that you are an expert in this area.
Oh, God. I don't know if I'd call myself an expert, but I've certainly looked into it recently. But I think, yeah, you've made all the kind of relevant points. And I think it's worth looking at it in the context of the general the public sector equality duty as well, because public sector employers have this duty, whereas, you know, in the private sector, there's no kind of mandatory obligation to consider these types of measures. So it's worth looking at it in that context, I think, because there's probably a kind of element of pressure for employers thinking actively considering positive action. And so it's obviously great that they have these kind of lofty diversity targets and they're doing all of these things and the adverts, etc. And, you know, trying to get to where they want to be in terms of their diversity targets. But the kind of distinction between positive action and positive discrimination is that it's often quite a grey line, a grey area, and positive discrimination, you know, in terms of just applying an automatic preference just because somebody has a protected characteristic, fundamentally, you just can't do that. That's unlawful. And as with anything, you know, the best person for that job, the most suitable person, the person that's got the relevant skills, the person that's got the experience, etc., the person that's passed all those tests, they should, you know, be in the running for that role. And just because they are white, they don't share, you know, the protected characteristic that you're trying to, you know, improve your stats on, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't get the job. It seems like it's common sense, but obviously when you put that into context of these diversity aims, it's slightly trickier, I appreciate, in practice. But, you know, any measures that are taken have to be proportionate. You have to think about, you know, could there be a way of achieving that aim in a way that is less unfavorable? Well, there's a better way of saying that, but less unfavorable to the person that doesn't have that protected characteristic. You know, is there another way? And invariably there will be. It just takes a bit of creativity and thought. And you just have to tick those boxes to get to the point at which you might be able to apply what we call a tiebreaker exemption. You have to get through certain stages of your process to be able to apply that. And I think inherently, one of the main difficulties with applying that tiebreaker exemption, as you've already said, Emma, is being able to say that two candidates are as of equal merit to one another. So it's great that
employers are trying to take positive action, but it's fraught with difficulty and risk.
So just looking at what positive action measures we've seen the RAF and other armed forces taking, we mentioned the advertising campaign, role models. The other thing I think that has increased the pipeline of diverse candidates is where you have women-only days, networking opportunities and recruitment days, and or ethnic minorities. And you see it in STEM, where you have just at schools and universities where you have women-only targeted recruitment. And that is allowed, but not recruitment. It's getting to know, get them interested in that respect. It's just where the policy, if there is a policy of excluding somebody, that's where it moves, as you say, crosses that grey line between positive action and positive discrimination, the latter being unlawful.
And the only case that we have on it really is it shows exactly that example of how a white man was made it through all of the stages, and then simply based on a kind of blanket policy wasn't able to progress to the next stage, and that obviously that went really badly for that employer. So there are definitely a lot of learning points there.
Yeah, that was the Furlong case with the recruitment process, where they had artificially lowered the pass rate to get to the next stage, where they were recruiting people from who were sharing the underrepresented protected characteristic, who were only scoring something like 70% in the test, and they were being offered the roles in and men were being passed over, even though they'd scored 90%. So it was that the police force were unable to say that they'd met that first element, that they were as equally qualified, because clearly somebody who was better qualified was being passed over in favour of the diversity. There wasn't that tie-break situation.
Yeah, and Cheshire Police were really criticised for not taking a holistic approach to the effectiveness of all of their measures, because they had a lot of other measures in place that had kind of meant that they were reaching or working towards their targets, yet despite that they decided to apply this tiebreaker exemption in a kind of inappropriate, disproportionate way, and they hadn't looked at what they were already doing. So I think that's also worth mentioning, that I'm sure employers have various different measures that they're taking, and they need to look at it as a whole to see what's effective, what isn't, what they need to change and what they need to update. So I think take us on to the third story. The 4-day working week pilot in the UK, which sounds fantastic on the face of it, I'm sure we all agree. So I'm sure many of our listeners will be aware, but thousands of people in the UK have recently been testing a 4-day schedule that could potentially help usher in a new era of work, a big emphasis on potentially. It's now the world's biggest trial of a 4-day work week so far, it's going to go on for 6 months, ending in November 2022, and it will commit 3,300 workers across 70 companies to work 80% of their usual week in exchange for promising to maintain 100% of their productivity. Importantly, there is the promise that there'll be no cut to their pay or benefits, but provided that their performance doesn't decrease either. It's being run by a not-for-profit 4-day week, Global Autonomy, and the 4-day week UK campaign in partnership with researchers from Cambridge and Oxford University and Boston College. And what they'll do is they'll eventually evaluate the impact of this 4-day working week on issues such as productivity, the environment, gender equality and worker wellbeing. And for some, it seems like, from what I've read about it, the verdict is already in. I think it's only been about 8 or 9 weeks since it started. Some have apparently said it's been life-changing. For others, it seems to have been more of an adjustment, but then finding ways of making it work and kind of thinking creatively about how to maximise that time during the 4 days that you have. So there are obviously potential benefits and disadvantages of a 4-day working week. Some of the factors kind of apply as a benefit and a disadvantage potentially. So it is, of course, firstly, quite a timely opportunity to focus on the ways in which employee wellbeing can be improved through more flexible forms of working. After the pandemic, obviously, there's been much more of a focus on burnout and stress. It's obviously the various different issues that employees have been going through during that time. And I think a McKinsey survey last year of 5,000 global workers found that nearly half reported feeling at least somewhat burnt out. So obviously it's very important to get to the bottom of this wellbeing issue and see what we can do as a nation to kind of help improve that en masse. Productivity, I think, potentially goes both ways, and it'll be interesting to see what the results are at the end of the pilot. Some research suggests that working longer hours can mean that productivity gradually decreases as workers can't sustain the same level of output throughout. Therefore, the introduction of a shorter week will mean an increase in productivity. But of course, the position isn't always clear cut, and it probably will vary from one profession, one industry to another. For example, professional services, you know, in our world where we work in, you know, on a basis where it's all based on the time you spend on matters, you could be facing a situation where you're having to work way longer into the evening just to make your time up because you know that you don't have Friday. And as we all know, sometimes Friday is desperately needed to get those deadlines met. So it's difficult to make generalizations because it will be completely different from one industry to another. So, yeah, I mean, and there's kind of issues with, you know, what the well-being factor is really, really key. And I think it's meant that a lot of individuals have felt that they can take up new hobbies and, you know, use their spare time in a better way. Use that Friday, if it's Friday or another day, use that time to kind of learn a language or spend time with their family or build relationships. And that's obviously hugely important too. And sometimes Saturday and Sunday just doesn't feel like it's long enough. But there's obviously lots of disadvantages potentially as well. Flexibility can't come at the expense of productivity. At the end of the day, we're all working for, you know, businesses, and businesses have to kind of tick over and continue to do what they do. And especially in kind of client-driven environments, if you're potentially faced with a situation where no one is around on a particular day, you might have quite, you know, dissatisfied or unhappy customers or clients. I was thinking in our own context, if you've got, you know, a court deadline, tribunal deadline that falls on a certain day, those deadlines have to be met. So unless everybody on, you know, in the whole of the country were to kind of adapt to that new way of a four-day working week, I don't think it would work because I'm just thinking about it from our perspective, you know, unless the court was particularly forgiving and said, oh, you've got your day off, that deadline's not be otherwise met. And then you'll have a very disgruntled, rightly so disgruntled client because you're there learning Spanish whilst missing their deadline. So there are various different, and also, you know, if you're in a regulated environment, there are certain regulatory compliance standards that you have to continue meeting. And you have to factor that all in when you're considering what that will mean potentially if you were to kind of reduce to a four-day working week. So those are just some of the things I was thinking. I don't know whether Emma and Wanu, you had any other thoughts on it, on how that would work, or whether you think it's a good thing or there are particular challenges that presents.
I think one of the most essential things of working a four-day week is having the ability to hand over to somebody else to enable you to take that fifth day off, whether it doesn't matter what day of the week it is, but increased collaboration between the team and collaboration with somebody who is able to pick up and run with your work on the day that you're not there. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's many, I have to say, I don't think that there's many roles controversially which can't be done on a four-day working week, putting myself on the edge there. Mm-hmm. But looking at it from a financial perspective, or working 4 days instead of five, it's the old adage, isn't it? Well, if you're a part-timer, you're more efficient than a full-timer because you've still got the same amount of work to do in four days than 5 days. I don't know to what extent that's true, but as you said, Pooja, in a professional services business, understanding how you can still generate sufficient revenue to cover a 100% of the salary for somebody who's working 80% of the time is interesting. So I am going to be interested in how the professional services businesses have coped in the this review period. But I am wondering whether 6 months is sufficiently long enough to do a review, because I could probably six months I think is really quite short term to review this. And it's just that 80, 100, 80% of the work for 100% of the pay. That would be great if actually 100%. But then I just think sometimes if you are having to, like you say, work into the evenings in order to make sure that all of the work is done within that period of time, because you are still being asked to do 100% of the work. It's interesting to see what the outcome is. There are obviously businesses who operate on a compressed hours basis and will allow people to already have done this. So it would be good to get them to feed into the study as well.
I saw a really interesting an interesting example of like what certain companies are doing and thinking of kind of creative ways of maximizing that time. And there was one company who introduced a traffic light system to prevent unnecessary disturbances, where colleagues actually have a light on their desk and set it to green if they're happy to talk, amber if they're busy but available to speak, and red if they don't want to be interrupted. And other companies have also introduced a concept of deep working time, in which time staff ignore emails, calls, Teams messages, and they just concentrate on their kind of their project work or their drafting, etc. So I think there are kind of creative ways in which you can really make that concept work in your organization if you really want to.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the physical traffic light system you just described, I think it's available via Teams. You utilize it to show when you're available, when maybe you're in a meeting, and when you're doing deep thinking work or work that, you know, where you don't want to be disturbed. Another thing I think will be interesting to look at is how people now who have shared jobs, who share their job with someone else, manage their working weeks, because those sorts of things might also be able to feed into how someone might be able to manage a 4-day working week where the business is open 5 days a week, but people are working different 4 days. So some people might not work on the Monday and some people might choose the Tuesday, and having a sort of a structured approach to the way that work is managed so that clients aren't affected. But also, as you mentioned, productivity also stays at the level that you need it to stay for the business to stay profitable. Within the professional services firms and industry, it is, like you say, more difficult. We do have the concept of the billable hour, and that is how money is made. But there might be other things that you want to look at, which is what are people doing in their day between, I don't know, let's say 12 and 3, are they being most productive at those times? Are there things that could be taken out of their day and could there be some other technology aid that can assist so that everything that someone's doing in that day is productive and you're maximizing the time that is being recorded profitable time? I don't think it's going to be a straightforward answer for professional services businesses. It's going to take a lot of investment and time and thinking. And if we do get it in the end, I mean, I for one won't be unhappy, but
same.
If we can balance everything out, but you know, you have to see. And as you say, Pooja, I think the difficulty will also be rolling it out to wider society. From a UK perspective, with everything going on in the economy, is it very likely that, you know, we're going to have across the board a change from a 5-day to a 4-day week? Probably, in my opinion, probably not. Not now, anyway. Maybe if the economy takes a turn and all of a sudden we're doing brilliantly on the world stage, that might change. But I don't see it happening in the immediate future, unfortunately.
There are a lot of other things that we're still waiting on, so I think this will have to wait in line.
Well, that's it, I think, for another episode of the Lawdown. And thank you so much for tuning in and listening to our discussions today. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out any information about what we've discussed today or have any questions, you can contact us. You can go to our website at www.cm-murray.com. And I think that's it from us. So we'll just say bye until next time.
Thanks very much.